My name is Stephen McCauley. I work for Computer Sciences Corporation, and I'm a product manager in their public health division. Today, we're going to focus on the early experiences of public health departments in responding to meaningful use, specifically focusing on the reportable laboratory result objective. Today we're also going to take a little bit different approach. We realize that everybody's probably pretty burnt out on PowerPoint, so we only have one slide. Hold me to it, okay? One slide. But today I'm going to be posing questions to our panelists, and we'll be discussing their insights. And given the room is pretty small, we're also going to try to make this very interactive. So as I ask questions to the panelists, be thinking about any comments that you would like to make, and simply raise your hand, and we'll get the conversation started. And don't be shy. I think most of us, we all know each other here. So let me just a few housekeeping items. Be sure to fill out your session evaluation if you're seeking the continuing education credits, and also please fill out a general conference evaluation. Neither the moderator nor any of the panelists have any conflicts of interest to report. We did want to just let everyone know this session is not intended to be a primer on meaningful use. We're going to focus on actually having rolled up the sleeves and done the work to make meaningful use valuable to improve public health outcomes. So with that, we're going to try not to use too much jargon, but if we do, raise your hand and we'll be happy to explore what we meant. So we think everybody in here understands there's three public health objectives. Okay, so I think we're good on that. And if not, come see me afterwards and we can chat about it. So let me start by introducing our panelists. So we have Doug Hammaker with the Texas Department of State Health Services. And Doug serves as being responsible for the NEDS and ELR infrastructure in Texas. And also we have Aaron Holt with the Tennessee Department of Health. Aaron is responsible for the NEDS program in Tennessee, and also is heavily involved with the communicable disease team. And then Keith Higginbotham from the Alabama Department of Health. Keith, like Doug, is also responsible for the infrastructure for ELR and NEDS. So these are actually the resources that are on the ground, working with the clinical data sources, working in the interoperability domain to make this happen. As you'll see from the slide, they are in various phases of the MU response, looking at towards the bottom of the slide, in terms of having onboarded hospitals already, and then also working with numerous hospitals. And while today's session will focus mainly on ELR, we are certainly up to discussing syndromic and also immunization. As you'll see from the slide, I know Erin is involved in that with her health information exchange. So this will be the only slide. I'm going to leave this up so as we're discussing, you can get a sense of who's talking and what their background is. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start the Q&A. And the first question is going to be posed to each panelist. We're going to start with Aaron. So, Aaron, how do you view the role of state health departments in meaningful use?
Well, I guess in Tennessee, the way we've kind of looked at it is we want to make sure that the Tennessee Department of Health enables meaningful use and promotes meaningful use in a way that is actually meaningful to public health. This is almost like a carrot. This is engaging us or allowing for the engagement with potential trading partners and maybe we haven't had conversations with before. The idea behind this is for the information to actually be used in a meaningful way to promote public health business. And so our idea is not simply to test for meaningful use, but to actually promote the public health business and use this as an opportunity to bring on trading partners and engage in trading partners that maybe we wouldn't have had the opportunity to speak with before. So it's really to promote that working relationship and to be able to provide our epidemiologists with maybe more data, better data, more reliable and valid information, more timely, so they can conduct their public health investigations and their interventions accordingly.
Thank you. Doug?
Ditto to what Aaron just said, what our expectations were in Texas. But it kind of goes a little bit earlier than that, too. I mean, we need to also look at the infrastructure that we've been working on for a number of years. And I think the expectations are that we have an infrastructure that's ready and prepared when meaningful use comes along. And so you need to go back several years. We don't go back to the implementation of meaningful use. We go back to the implementation of, are we ELR ready? You know, do we have an infrastructure that can accept a 251 message? You know, so our expectations were that we do have the infrastructure. You know, we have the Orion Rhapsody product to accept, route, and, you know, map and do what we need to do with an ELR message so that it can then be handed over. Yes, we are a NEDS-based system state. We had to have the ability to consume that message as well, too, so that then that message could be actionable, you know, immediately at the local health department level. So we really needed to have the responsibility that as meaningful use comes along, that we could work with it immediately. So, I mean, the interesting part of that is that I think we were ready for meaningful use before meaningful use came along, but we weren't getting those partners to come up and step up to the table. So as Aaron said, this is the carrot. Now meaningful use is providing some monetary incentives for those hospitals to start working with the infrastructure that we've been begging for them to come to the table for previously. So it's been kind of a neat partnership there in terms of how those regulations came down.
Keith, and you can use this microphone, Keith.
All right. I don't know that I can add a whole lot more to that. but in Alabama, you know, along with what Doug said, we were already doing ELR with the large national labs. One thing that we wanted to make sure is that we were not a barrier to hospitals being able to onboard and send us data. But again, if meaningful use didn't exist, this was still our primary goal, was to get ELR from our hospitals. So just having the infrastructure ready and prepared, and then just being willing and having the resources to be able to work with them to get them onboarded.
Great. So moving forward, and this question will be to Doug, what are the expectations in your state, whether coming from the state health officer, the state epidemiologist, or your senior leadership team, on the role of the communicable disease surveillance team in meaningful use?
Okay, I think I'm going to kind of remember what I just said about the expectations, and then now let's take it down one level to the operations of that, you know, of that infrastructure that we've been building. I'm in the business practice of working with hospital labs. I'll take away the word hospital. I'm in the business of working with laboratories to get data from their laboratory to public health and make it actionable. Where does attestation fit into all of that? And Stephen said we wouldn't be using all of the jargon words, but where do I fit into attestation? Where do I fit into certification? I really don't. I mean, I don't have the infrastructure. I didn't build the infrastructure around meaningful use. I built the infrastructure around building a public health reporting system. So what I can do is work very hard and very strenuously in getting them into a compliant message to come to public health. What I can't do is be the meaningful use police. I can't come in and tell them if they're doing their routing right. I can't tell if a message came from an EHR or if it came from a word processor. all I can look at is to see, does that message, whenever I receive it, does it do the actions that I need it to do? Is it have the attributes to make it interoperable for me within my public health system? I need to leave the meaningful use police type activities to someone else, because we didn't build our infrastructure around that. We built our infrastructure around public health.
Doug, just as a follow-up to that, what type of support do you find for that position within your organization?
I find good, strong leadership, and it does, I mean, it's a partnership with even within our organization to make sure that our leadership understood where we were coming from and you know, participating in some of the meaningful use steering committees and strategic planning within our own state health department, I think has been vital in making sure that the communication all along the various parts of the administration, that we all know exactly what it is that our expectations are within our unit, thus within the department, thus, you know, across our entire agencies, of what we are supposed to do in terms of public health, as opposed to, you know, some type of a guide or you know, participant in the meaningful use, you know, check marking that goes along to see if somebody is you know, meeting the requirements.
Keith or Aaron, anything to add to Doug's comments?
Well, in Tennessee, I mean, I'll echo what Doug said, but I'll take it one step further. You know, in my role, I think my job is to just make sure that it works. When it comes time for the state epidemiologist to ask me what the status of the work surrounding these projects is, is it functional? Does it work? Do you have the EOR flowing to your surveillance systems? And it's not necessarily just our NED system, but also our STD system, our HIV, our EHARS system. So making sure that information is shared amongst all the program areas. So if we're getting a huge volume of STD tests, which might represent, you know, between 40 and 60% of the ELR that we get, is that information actually reaching the program area for them to be able to take action on it? So just making sure that it's functional. In addition, being able to communicate between the epi side of the house and our IT side of the house to make sure that we're speaking the same language and working towards a common goal, as well as being the epidemiologist to communicate with labs to be able to articulate what exactly it is that we want to see in those messages, what exactly is reportable from the laboratories. Because sometimes that information, though conceptually might be the same when you're talking about reportables in general, might be the same between labs and providers, but when you really get down to the nitty-gritty and some of the vocabulary, it is different in how you ask the questions. You might ask for an organism as opposed to a condition. So being able to articulate exactly what it is that you want, as well as just making it work, is I find that's what our role in Tennessee is in this position.
Keith, any follow-up comments? So, Aaron, in follow-up to that last question, how have these expectations changed over the past year, given that Tennessee has been at this now for approximately a year, responding to meaningful use? How have expectations changed over the year?
Probably to do it faster. to do it faster, again, to be able to more articulately communicate with labs, to be able to communicate with them what it is that we want. In addition, now we're having to provide additional documentation. For instance, I'm also the one that's going to be required for putting together our meaningful use website. I'm the one that's going to be required for sending out the whether or not you've tested letters or emails, working with our health information exchange. So there's all these additional interoperable exchange type related projects that are kind of creeping into the scope.
Okay. Doug, Keith, anything to add in terms of the evolution of the expectations?
I was just going to say, early on, you know, we've been doing ELR since about 2005, and you know, onboarding a national lab, for us at least, takes a long time. And so when meaningful use came along, our senior leadership, they were involved and they were aware of what we were doing with ELR, with the large national labs, but we really had to educate them and explain to them the entire process and you know, how in the weeds we have to go with these labs. It's not, they kind of had the concept that it was plug and play. Okay, there's a standard out there. Everyone's going to adhere to that standard. So right out of the box, you should get a compliant message. What's the big deal? So we had to educate them, kind of bring them along, and really change their expectations, because they did think, you know, you talk to the lab, you get them to agree to it, they send you a message, and we're done. However, it's not quite that simple. So setting their expectations first, and then also setting the expectations of the lab that you're dealing with. We oftentimes, the labs think that, you know, we are part of the attestation body. You know, we're going to certify them. We're not taking that role. We are not the attestation meaningful use police.
Doug?
I could not have said it better than what Keith just did. So, very, very similar experience, I think, to both of these guys. But very, very similar to what Keith just said.
Okay. So, this next question is for Keith. So, within your state, what stakeholders are you working with to effectively respond to meaningful use stage one? Whether you're HIT coordinator or Medicaid, etc.
This is probably an area where you could maybe learn from our mistakes. We probably did not engage our partners soon enough in the process. Medicaid would be one of those. We've had some meetings with them. Really, it was us going to them saying, what do you expect public health's role to be in meaningful use? You know, do you expect us to be the attestation? Are you going to come back to us and say, you know, XYZ hospital has said that they've sent you a message, and you know, are you expecting us to send you data to confirm that? Working with our recs, we've kind of had a love-hate relationship with them, because some of the information that they were passing out to hospitals initially was kind of misinformation. So, you know, we would get a call from a hospital and they would say, we understand that you guys don't receive ELR or have the capacity to receive ELR, and we're like, well, yes we do, where did you hear that from? So we really should have gotten involved earlier in the process. That's probably my fault. So if you take anything away from this, I would encourage you to go ahead and find out who your HIT coordinator is, if you don't already know that, who your meaningful use coordinator is at your state, if it's not, you know, someone within your group. Work with your Medicaid office and find out what their expectations are of public health.
Doug? Stakeholder involvement.
I'm laughing because I think that Keith and I have had some fairly similar experiences on that one, but some subtle differences as well too. You know, our agency HIT coordinator has been intimately involved with our process all along in building our infrastructure and putting together what we have. So we already had that relationship, and so there was already that awareness and that understanding of what we had and what some of those expectations were. We have had a number of meaningful use steering committee type infrastructures built as well too. So, and we were the NEDS group, the ELR group, was naturally brought into those. And at that point we did bring together Medicare, Medicaid, and I think what was really incredible was that from the beginning our Medicaid coordinator sat down and didn't necessarily talk about what they expected from us, or they sat down and said, what's your business process? What is it that you do, you know, for ELR? What's your process for bringing on a lab? And so what we did is we talked about that flow and understanding how we did what we needed to do. Again, just like Keith has said, it's not plug and play. So what kind of hand-holding did we do? What type of communication did we have with hospitals and laboratories as they were coming on board? Whenever a hospital or a laboratory was working with us and trying to bring on new messages, how did we work with them? When we finally went into production, how did we do that? What were the milestones? What were the hallmarks? And then we wove in how that attestation communication could be drawn from our existing business processes, as opposed to having to build up a whole mechanism for this is how we're going to start doing things for meaningful use because of meaningful use. No, it was more of a draw off of some of our naturally occurring business processes that would then just be extended over to be included in the documentation that Medicaid was going to be needing to have. And that's also gone over to our Medicare process as well, too.
Aaron, any thoughts on stakeholder involvement?
Yeah, so Tennessee's, I guess, a little bit different than some of my other states. A lot of our health information technology associated with these federal initiatives is not located within the Tennessee Department of Health. It's actually, some of it's located within our Department of Finance and Administration. It's actually where our Office of eHealth and our Health Information Technology Coordinator is located. I think because of that, there's been a lot of, we're all familiar with having to go up the food chain to facilitate communication between bureaus, departments, and different organizations. And I think because of that, making sure that a knowledgeable public health representative is actually at the table has been a bit of a struggle. And I think right now, at least in Tennessee, we're really starting to have those difficult conversations that it sounds like my colleagues in Texas and Alabama have already had. Being able to go through the onboarding process, to be able to describe to our colleagues in these other, in the Office of eHealth and Health Information Technology offices, that it is not plug and play, that there's a lot of vocabulary validation that has to occur, that there's, you know, yes, there is the following the HL7 implementation guide, but there's, you're going to have a little bit of wiggle room with every trading partner that you're working with, because again, the whole idea behind this is to facilitate communication between a public health entity and somebody who is reporting, not necessarily just testing and checking off a box. So in Tennessee, we've been very diligent about trying to be at the table when a lot of these discussions have been happening. So we're not just focusing on certain aspects of meaningful use, but making sure that meaningful use is applicable and meaningful to public health.
Okay. And just a reminder, we want to take questions interactively. So as we're going through, just raise your hand if you'd like to contribute something, or if you have a follow-on question. We don't want to wait till the end. And if you please, and if you wouldn't mind, just who you are and perhaps your role in meaningful use, just to give context.
Sure. So first, I'll describe the way our HIE infrastructure is set up. So in Tennessee, we have a network of networks. So we have six RIOs, or we call them qualified health organizations, or smaller, more local networks. And those networks come together as a larger network to form our statewide HIE. So local health providers are not directly connecting to a larger state HIE, but we have... they have to be a part of a qualified organization. To be a part of that qualified organization, they have to meet certain requirements, and then those qualified organizations come together and interoperate through trust brokering to form the state health information exchange. So there's that. Keeping that in mind, a lot of the participants currently, and this is obvious, but are in the Health Information Exchange are providers and hospitals. So a lot of their focus has been predominantly from the public health standpoint on immunizations. And so up until this point, a lot of the discussions, well, all of the discussions in regarding public health have been regarding immunization registry submissions. It hasn't been until very recently that we started having the conversation about ELR. We actually, maybe about 2 weeks ago, our HIE team came over, statewide HIE team came over and started having conversations with us about ELR, and they're just beginning the learning stages. I think there's a lot of misconceptions amongst the medical community or the health community in Tennessee about what reporting is, what it is not, what we do with the information. So I think there's going to be lots of discussion and education about what ELR is in relative to the entire reporting process. And so we're just starting out. Again, they were also in the mindset that it's just plug and play. I don't think that they had any idea of the vocabulary validation that's going to be required. I think that was greatly underestimated. But we are starting to have those conversations now, and I think the more we get into it, hopefully the more that they will realize the benefit it can provide to their participants as well as to us. But we're just beginning.
Yes. Well, I would say for the most part that it's the individual. We have about 4,500 individual providers across the state, give or take some, obviously. And for the most part, they have been focused on the immunizations. And a lot of the individual providers, who are associated with hospitals and groups and practices are also participating. And so I think from the hospital perspective, they have more hospitals from the organizational standpoint have been more focused on ELR and syndromic surveillance. But I think a lot of the weight has been given to the immunizations. Doug or Keith, anything to add to that?
In our early experiences in hospitals in particularly, it seems like most of the hospitals are focusing in on syndromic surveillance, which is something that we really don't do in Alabama. We're working towards that. So, you know, we have the job to try to convince them and show them the benefits of ELR. And, you know, in my mind, ELR is mutually beneficial. Obviously, our EPIs want it, but also it reduces their reporting burden. And so just, you know, getting them to realize, okay, we think at least that you're going to get more out of ELR. That's how we're encouraging them.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Denise Meadows McKesson. I am in the program office for UCSF Health Reform. And to the point that everyone's making about how you get people interested in ELR, I think one of the things we should look forward to is the fact that in stage three, our proposal is that all three options are going to be required for a provider. So it would actually improve our providers in our public health department to start thinking about getting ready.
I think everyone in this room would agree with that assessment about turning on the fire hose. Panelists, any comments?
Yeah, I declined to comment earlier because we cheated. We know the questions.
So that's why I wanted to get the audience involved.
And because I know I'd actually be addressing that, and it's going to be another question. So the next time it comes up, I'm going to hit it real quick. But knowing that it's coming up in stage two, I mean, that's the carrot. We have a lot of hospitals that are wanting to attest to either syndromic, just like Keith's saying, we're trying to encourage more towards, you know, but we're ready for ELR, and the same thing with immunizations, that they may go to immunizations, and it's not necessarily a competition, which one of the three do you want to be hitting. What we're looking for is we've got an infrastructure, we've got it ready, and at some point, this isn't going to be optional, it's going to be required. So let's get that movement going right now, and we try to have the dialogue when hospitals call in and say, okay, I need to know if you're ready for ELR. And it's like, yes, we are, and what stages, what steps do you want to be having? Where are you? What type of systems do you have in place? Knowing that if you don't get it into place for stage one, you will be required to have it in stage two, so that, you know, the earlier the better. Because again, we're looking at it as extending out our infrastructure for public health being able to receive standardized messages to have actionable information at the local health department level sooner than later. So, you know, I think that's a real good point to say that stage two may take some of the options out of their hands in terms of the timetable of when they need to be doing this.
We have a request from
Jerry. You can tell everybody who you.
Jerry Sable, St. John Group. We have a request from the virtual conference that the speakers repeat the questions,
okay,
or else the
questions. I'll certainly do that. Sorry, Jerry. Yes, let me take the question up front, and then Emily.
Virginia Barnes, Kansas. You mentioned something that kind of triggered this question, but have you had any, are you just taking, you know, whoever contacts you, or have you had any stakeholder available who is collecting possible hospitals and kind of getting an idea in your state of what stages they are planning on doing the employee submitting so you can prepare better, or is it really just been whoever?
So for those of you on the virtual conference, the question was from Virginia Barnes from Kansas in regards to the planning, assessing the landscape of hospitals' readiness prior to, so public health can then plan better. Does that articulate your question? Okay.
We actually, about a couple months ago, the Tennessee Department of Health worked with our Health Information Technology Office and put together a survey of labs across the state of Tennessee, so not just hospitals, but any facility that had a lab or a CLIA number, to assess their readiness, their capability, what kind of information they currently report. Do they report to public health? If they do, what do they report? Do they use LOINC codes, SNOMED codes? Are they HL7 capable? If they're not, what other mechanisms of reporting do they use? What kind of LIM systems do they use? And we're in the process now of finishing up the collection of that information and analyzing it. As of right now, I have about 40 or 50 facilities that we're either actively engaged in, or we have almost like in a queue that we know maybe later this fall we're going to start the conversations with them. I'm good for right now. We have enough people that we're working with at the moment, but definitely going forward it will help us prioritize those additional facilities.
Keith or Doug?
Go ahead.
Okay.
At first we were kind of looking to, well, when they're ready, they'll know how to get a hold of us. We did put together web pages that said for meaningful use, this is who and how you contact each one of the three levels. But kind of early on, we also, in participation with our HIV-STD group, did a survey through our Texas Hospital Association of all hospitals across the state. And some of the questions were, ELR readiness, and where were you with regard to stage one meaningful use, and, you know, trying to get an understanding of what, as you can see, we've got a number of acute care hospitals in Texas that, you know, are we going to be hit with a tsunami of requests to do a phenomenal amount of work in a very short amount of time, or, you know, did we need to do any kind of staging or queuing or anything along those lines, and the problem is that survey, was at that point in time, basically earlier this year, and the landscape's changed. We were finding at that time a lot of hospitals, I think, weren't aware of, weren't fully cognizant of, and quite frankly, I think the rules weren't solidified enough at that time to have a true understanding of what their timetable would be at the hospital level itself. Things have changed and things are evolving, so there's starting to become a difference in their attitudes of when and how they want to be moving through. And actually, some that answered, you know, previously that we'll wait for this whole meaningful use stuff to solidify before we start, you know, working with it, are now knocking on our door saying, you know, we're ready to move forward. We also have been working with our CMS group as well to actually find out who is going through the process, who's said that they already have an EHR that and they're ready to attest, so that we kind of get a better understanding of at least a barometer of if we're not getting a lot of hospitals, you know, knocking on our doors, are they going a different route? You know, can we herd this all into one, you know, straight funnel? So yeah, there was some of that engagement in terms of trying to find out who's doing what and when are they going to be ready. But then again, at the same time, my action plan is to be available and accept those calls and then work with them as they come in.
Keith?
In Alabama, early on, we decided to build a meaningful use registration website. And so we've kind of incorporated that survey tool within their registration. So again, like Texas, again, early on, we assumed, okay, they're just going to come to us, they'll register. When they register, we're going to ask them, you know, about their capabilities for message generation, what their interests are. Are they interested in immunization only, or are they interested in all three public health messages? We ask them information about their transport capabilities. It not only gives us information about them, but it helps us keep track of who is interested, what stage they are in with us. Are they in the engagement stage? Are they in the validation stage, testing, production, et cetera? We also use that website to provide information back to them. So our specific state messaging constraints on top of these messages, we provide that. We have an overview document for each of the three meaningful use data categories that basically just kind of outlines, okay, here's what the whole process looks like. Here's how you start with us, and then the next step, and et cetera. So again, our survey tool was kind of built into that. We've had pretty good success as far as hospitals coming to us, vendors coming to us that represent private providers within Alabama. We recently reached out to ALAHA, which is our Alabama Hospital Association, to try to get the word out about our meaningful use registration website. So we are a little afraid once that word goes out, we're going to be overwhelmed. Again, we don't have nearly as many hospitals as Doug has to worry about, but 110 is a pretty large number.
I would just add from my experiences in working on assessments for meaningful use, it's critical that you go into a very detailed questions, as Keith was saying, you know, specific messaging standards, capabilities. You know, I think 2 to 3 pages of questions is probably what's needed to truly assess. I have seen assessments where they were very well put together, but they just didn't go into enough detail. So then when the phone calls were made by public health, it went nowhere. So it's something to be cognizant of. Yes. So let me summarize that question for the virtual audience. So that was Cammie from Montana, and the question was around the understanding of ELR from the hospital and the readiness from their current EHR infrastructure. Which is certified. That do your question justice, Cammie? Okay. We'll just start with whoever would like to start.
I'll start out. We've actually had a hospital and their certified vendor contact us, want to get involved with ELR. One of their first questions, do you have a specific messaging guide that you want us to use? Which kind of caught me off guard. Because I just assumed that they understood the final rule specified the exact guide. So once you mention that, then, well, can you send it to me? Well, no, I can. It's an HL7 product. You know, if you're certified, you would think that they already knew that. But anyways, I digress. And then we've also had...
Oh, no, Keith, I think this is the audience where you should keep going.
Well,
raise your hand if you want Keith to keep going.
So then we've also had an experience with an ONC certified system where they send us their first test message. We run it against the NIST validator just to kind of check it first, and it produces 110 errors. Again, I guess I'm naive. I assume an ONC certified system would produce a message that would pass at least the NIST validator tool. So that's been our experience. Now, I will say that hospital quickly and that vendor quickly was able to resolve those messages, and we actually have them in production. So,
Aaron?
We had a very similar situation, and actually because of that, the very first thing we do from that point going forward, the very first thing that we now do is we have an initial conversation with the vendor staff, the hospital staff, including maybe an ICN or an ICP, some lab staff, epidemiology and IT from the Tennessee Department of Health. We get on the phone and we talk about what is reporting. You're already sending us, you should be, this information. Hopefully you are. So we talk about reporting. We talk about ELR, lab reporting. We talk about the requirements that are going to be that we're going to have regarding certain vocabulary. We talk about the mechanism by which this information is going to be transported. What options are available? Are we going to use FinMS? Are we going to use Secure FTP? We talk about making sure that we're on the same page as far as what specification that they're supposed to use, whether or not they have that specification. We attempt to have that conversation at the onset, at the very initial point, to make sure that we're all on the same page. So when we get that first test message, it's not an immunization message that the ELR group is getting or something like that.
One of the issues here is that the three of us are going to say ditto to each other because we talk to each other an awful lot. We share a lot of the same products. We share a lot of the same experiences, and we get on the phone whenever we have issues. So we've experienced in Texas something very similar to what both of the others have said. One of the things that we have done routinely, though, is put together a what we expect to be just a very rough form of a messaging guide. So whenever the 251 specification came out, this was before meaningful use, we were starting to put together a what do we expect the message construct to be according to those standards. Our experience has been we've engaged a number of different ONC certified, and I am using the air quotes, of ONC certified vendor systems, and without fail, every time we've received a message, it has not been, consumable directly. There are issues with them every time. What we're typically doing and what we have done, and it wasn't a surprise when we received those messages and they couldn't come through, because we've been actually actively engaging with the vendor themselves, and actually several of us have kind of tag teamed on the vendors as they're trying to certify and or not certify as they're trying to roll into production in Texas. They may be also working in Tennessee, and what's really nice is when we have that common voice between the two of us of, okay, this is where you need to work on your message. That's been very, very powerful. But as we've said in the past, this isn't plug and play. It would be nice if it was, but it's not. Even if you're looking at just straight national standards. One of the reasons that we did put into our place an implementation guide is that we do have what we're calling Texas-specific constraints. The way that we're expecting to have that data come over to us, very specifically within the results component of the fields, there are certain very, very tight requirements that are part of the national implementation standards that we're expecting it to come across. And we're very, very flexible in some of the other components, you know, within the NIST certifications or any of the other validations that may come along in terms of variances that would be allowed. But there are some very specific, the way you have results, you know, resulted test names, and the way that you express the results for those resulted test names, very, very tight on that. So, you know, from the very get-go, we talked to the vendors about what our expectations are on that. And we, you know, again, it's not plug and play.
Yeah, go ahead.
One other follow-up. Something that Doug said triggered this thought. Again, when I was talking about explaining to our senior leadership, kind of getting into the weeds about how much time and effort is going to be involved in validating messages for each individual hospital or lab that we deal with, I used the phrase that Doug coined, which is ocular validation. So you really do have to get in and read the messages, because it could very well pass an NIST validator tool, your MQF tool. It may even go, your system may be able to consume it, but the information is not usable, so you really do have to get in there and check visually. And that's where the majority of our time is spent, is through that ocular validation.
Aaron, anything to add?
Yeah, I just want to echo that. I mean, we've attempted, we're actually in the process of using MSS and Rhapsody to build some filters and some validation tools that are a little bit more automated than the tried and true ocular validation, but as far as initial testing, there really isn't anything, at least from our perspective, that beats sitting down with the implementation guide and the HL7 message and just going through it field by field. I mean, especially when you start looking at the vocabulary, how you want some of those HD data types reported, you know, all of that stuff. There really isn't, at least from our perspective, anything that really beats sitting down with the implementation guide and flipping through it.
Sounds like a fun Friday night.
Oh yeah, good times.
Let me, but Kathy, before I take your question, let me pose a follow-up, and then Kathy, I'll come back. As an extension of what we just talked about, how do you see, in what Cammy raised, what do you see the role of your RECs, your regional extension centers, in that process and that education process with the vendors and with the hospitals? If you wouldn't mind sharing your experiences.
I just, within the last month, learned about the REC infrastructure in Texas by meeting with our Health and Human Services Commission representative for HIT. So it was an unknown infrastructure, it's an unknown capacity, but we're going to be you know, potentially engaging with them in the future. So heretofore, we've just not really known about this. We've not used that infrastructure at all.
Aaron?
So when we first started talking about meaningful use, one of the first things that we did is we put together these one-page fact sheets, one on ELR, one on syndromic surveillance, and one on the immunization registry submissions. And the idea was that if you're a provider, vendor, or hospital, regardless of your knowledge of the technical specifications, you could go to that fact sheet and get an idea of what's available, where the Tennessee Department of Health is, what their status is, and who to contact to get more information. So the idea was that we could put that on our website, provide that to our RECs, so when they get questions from facilities, they can just say, here's the one pager on syndromic surveillance, here's the one pager on ELR. Well, we finalized those several months ago. And actually, probably last week or the week before, I actually got an email from our REC, which was the only direct communication that I've had with our REC, asking for the Tennessee Department of Health's position on syndromic surveillance. So one of the facilities contacting them could get an exemption, basically. So up until this point, that's pretty much been our experience. Now, I know that through our HIE, the recs have been doing quite a bit of work with our trading partners out in the field and promoting the HIE. But as far as meaningful use specific in the public health criteria, not a whole lot.
Okay. Keith?
I think our expectation of what the rec's role is differs from what they think or what their role is with meaningful use. I think from our initial discussion with them, their primary focus, at least in Alabama, is to, they basically had vendors come in, showcase their EHR systems to them. They narrowed it down and kind of, I guess, negotiated some pricing points. And then they go out, talk with specifically some of the rural providers, encourage them to buy one of these kind of approved systems. And that's essentially it. When we spoke with them, they weren't even aware of the public health meaningful use requirements. So we've educated them on that. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, there was a lot of misinformation that they were passing on to hospitals prior to that discussion. So we had to do a lot of correction and, you know, informing hospitals, yes, we can accept DLR, yes, we can accept immunizations. Because it's interesting. You can tell probably within the first 5 minutes of a conversation with a lab or with a provider, are they just looking for an exemption or do they really want to share data with you?
So I think this question will take any insights from the audience. I know this is a much discussed topic before we come back and take Kathy's question. So I'll certainly throw that out to the audience, experiences with RECs, given we have a cross-section of the country here. Cammie, then Leslie Ann, then Kathy. Absolutely. Thank you, Darcy.
Well, I have the mic. I might want to publicly.
Well, I was going to. I
want to publicly recognize the years of collaboration Steve McCauley has given us. I think a lot of us have had
Thank you, Dr. Brenner.
The business relationship.
Thank you. Sir. Wait a minute. Leslie Ann first, Dr. Sprenick. Oh, Cammie, sorry.
Well, I guess it's more of a comment, maybe a question, but it seems as if all three of you are experiencing the same things that probably most of us are experiencing with our RAC and our HIEs, maybe. So I'm wondering, as a whole, how do we maybe fix this? Because it seems as if maybe CMS, ONC, isn't giving the RECs the right information on how they should engage us as well. Because it's difficult for us to find out who they are and what they're doing. And so maybe is there a way or is there some message that we should say to these partners nationally to engage the states appropriately with their activities? Because they're not training or educating their providers with what the public health pieces could or could not be.
Well, I'll make a comment. I'll shield my state colleagues. My comment would be follow the money. Where is their funding coming from? How is it funded? Grants, whatever it may be, and go back to that source. To me, that's how you address what you've raised. Much like everyone here receives funding, you go back and you start at that source, and it's really only there can you push down to implement the changes that I think we all agree need to be made. That's just my perspective from a vendor.
I'm Leslie Ann Helms from Virginia, and our experience with our REC has been absolutely the opposite of what you guys are talking about. We did the initial reach out. But this is, these are publicly funded. There's one in every state. It's on the ONC webpage. It's on our state webpage. So we found it really easy to figure out who they were. We called them, explained who we were and what we were doing. We wanted to meet with them. They set up, they brought their executive director, they brought their manager, they brought their field folks. They brought them all in because they wanted to hear what we were doing. We had a really constructive meeting. They appreciated the fact that we reached out to them. Sorry. They've asked us to be on their monthly calls where they do education for physicians so that we could share the public health stuff. They asked for our website so they could refer people there. They really have a target audience, and it is those small-scale docs who need help doing this stuff. But our folks are, they have monthly calls for technical support. They have people who go out and do technical support with the docs. They do help them with the selected EHRs, because those are the ones they think are affordable and, you know, quality. And but they're really encouraging them to help, you know, to do the public health messages, particularly the immunization one, because that's the one that's most relevant to them. And truthfully, that's the one we'd like them to promote to the docs. But we've had a really constructive relationship simply by reaching out to them, because they saw us as a really valuable tool.
I have had a similar experience to Leslie Ann. Our rec is has two states, Washington and Idaho, and the collaboration has been absolutely wonderful. Like Leslie Ann, we're pushing the immunization for providers right now because it's the easy pickings for them. But along those lines, I just want to throw out there, I think a lot of what's going on has to do with communication. And I'm going to ask the panelists, but if anybody else in the room has any insight, that would be, I would love to hear it. We talked about some of the guides for, you know, the labs, you know, what kind of messages do I have to send. And there's the HL7 guide, but there's also these state-specific requirements, state-specific reportable diseases, all of this stuff. How are we making that available to the labs before they pick up that phone and call, or before they send that email, so that they have the opportunity to really digest what we would be asking them to do before they're engaging us? Because you can well imagine if you're a lab and you're getting on the phone and all you know is that there's this meaningful use criteria that you have to meet, and there's some kind of HL7 guide out there, and those are the two pieces of information you have. It's not a very comfortable way to start a conversation. So I was just, I know we're talking about recs right now, so.
No,
but again, that it's all about communication, and if we can go off on a tangent, and I would like to get other states, how other states are putting that communication out there. Is it a website? Are you blasting emails? Are you going through your hospital association? You know, I would like to get some, I would like to see what everybody else is doing so I can maybe improve on my communication in my state.
So let me start with the panel, and then we'll open it up to the audience.
Just go down the right.
Yep.
I agree with you 100%, Kathy. I mean, it's all about communication, and that's why for ELR, having the 251 specification, you know, kind of behind the firewall, you have to purchase that specification. It's intellectual property that's licensed and can't be shared. That's why our driver was to have a state specific guide that did follow that specification, because I couldn't take the HL7 251 specification and email it to my partners. I would be breaking copyright. So that's why we have a state specific guide. We took that guide as well as our recommendations through experience of how to implement, you know, kind of having a work plan. You want to implement with the Texas Department of Health, these are the steps that we feel you should go through. Some of the engagement, the connection, you know, establish your connections, go in and validate your messages, and then moving into production. Have a very stepwise approach for how to manage that process, put those into two independent documents so that we could send them out and get that communication going without having to say, okay, now go to this website and buy this implementation guide, et cetera, like that. We do have websites that is available to, so that we can point to people that are or they can come across and you know, Google Texas Department of State Health Services meaningful use and land up and get to those guides as well too. Interested partners, it's freely available, so we can mail it out. If a hospital calls us up and says, you know, I'm kind of thinking about that meaningful use thing. I think I have to do something for ELR. Can you tell me what, you know, what needs to be done? We can send them out the guide. It has a, you know, all the way down to which MSH we are expecting and which OBX we're expecting. So it's very, very specific, as well as a suggested implementation plan of how to step through this and try to get them off of the idea as well up front to think and realize this is not going to be plug and play. You're not going to be able to all of a sudden turn on your EHR product and you know, next week start getting your Medicaid money. It just, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. So it's communication and trying to open up those pathways. You're exactly right.
So we have a very similar document to what Doug just described. We call ours something different. Instead of calling it a state specification or a guide, we have a trading partner agreement, and it's not a legal document. In fact, any time we're working with a trading partner and their lawyers get a hold of it, and then you know, they're wanting to ask us legal questions and go into those kinds of discussions, we say whatever language is in that trading partner agreement that is requiring the involvement of your legal department, let's reword it, let's get it out. It's purely a document to say we are on the same page, that we're talking about electronic laboratory reporting, that we understand, that both parties understand what exactly that means, what the business case is, what transport mechanisms are available that are common to both parties that we can investigate. And then it references the HL7 implementation guide, which is itself a constraint on the actual HL7 standard. So what we do in our trading partner agreement is any deviations from that implementation guide or any constraints on that implementation guide, we specifically list out. So we're not actually taking chunks of implementation guide out and putting it into a document and going that route. Basically, we're just outlining, if you have the standard and you have the implementation guide, you're pretty good to go. Here are some Tennessee-specific things to keep in mind while you're building. So if they approach us and they already have the standard and they already have the implementation guide, which hopefully they do have because they have a certified system and they had to generate the message to pass the NIST validation tool, then they should be pretty good to go by the time they're contacting us and we have that initial discussion and we go over the trading partner agreement. Now, obviously, that's not always the case. There's a lot of discussion that has to be had, and we have to go through that. One of the big kickers is the LOINT codes and SNOMED codes and the associated descriptions. That's always in itself a long series of conversations back and forth, bantering, trying to work through that. But the way we work is when we first have the engagement call, we make sure that they have the necessary HL7 documents and that they've gone through it. Then we have the trading partner agreement. We go through that. But we, for metrics and assessment purposes, we don't necessarily put that trading partner agreement up on a site for anybody to download, because we want to make sure that we're involved in the discussion and involved in their implementation from the get-go. Hopefully they will have already had the implementation guide and the standard by that point.
Keith?
We've taken a similar approach. Publicly on our ADPH website, we have, you know, a typical overview of basically what is meaningful use, you know, who do you need to contact, how do you need to register. Once a provider or a lab registers with us, then it's a secure registration. They have to log into our website. Then we actually start providing them more nitty-gritty details about our state-specific constraints, messaging guides. We also have a trading partner agreement, an overview document. And then we also have, like Tennessee, a call with all the interested parties. You know, if they're interested in immunizations, we have that group on board, plus IT. So we kind of take the military approach of tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So. And because of that, don't underestimate the amount of time that and resources you're going to have to spend in engagement. I think Stephen probably coined that term. The engagement process takes a lot of time to even get them to the point where they're comfortable enough to send you a message.
So let me open it up to the audience to to address Kathy's question.
Jenny Meadows McKesson, at the risk of possibly being the only vendor in the room.
You're not alone. You're not alone.
We came to get, I have three other people here, and we're really trying to get more educated about where our public health departments are. We applaud the efforts of the panelists, and it sounds like a lot of the folks in the room. One of the things, though, that we're struggling with, if you think about us as a vendor perspective, first of all, our customers are looking at us to help them with all of this, and not just public health, but everything related to meaningful right. use. It's, you know, new to them. Public health reporting is actually fairly new to us, other than immunization registry reporting. And so we're all kind of in this together trying to struggle. One of the things that has been the most challenging for us is trying to understand where every state is, where your information is, how we can help our customers, because we have customers in every state. So we have customers trying to basically connect with every public health agency out there. We have actually suggested, there was a vendor meeting Monday afternoon with the CDC, and a lot of folks were there, and I think some of you may have been there. We have suggested some way of at least getting this information in a more concise location, or having some way of knowing where the information is. And also, kind of when it comes down to the individual state requirements, the one thing I think we have to keep in mind is, because we, as the vendor, are really having to do this for our customers, every time we go to a different state and we have to do something differently, unfortunately, it's costing us a lot of money. So I guess this isn't so much of a question, but more of a plea. If we could find some way to really communicate the information a little bit more concisely, know how to get that information, and then think about areas where we can be a little bit more consistent. Understandably, there are reasons why every state does have specific requirements, but if we could be as consistent as possible, I think this will really help us as we move forward.
Well, thank you for your insights and your willingness to come and share amongst the group. I know it's appreciated. Dr. Sofranik?
First of all, we're thrilled to have McKesson here. And, you know, I was in charge. I was on the committee for the large labs and the national labs, and it's a great idea. We should have suggested maybe actually having a one-day meeting and inviting all the lab vendors to come down. And, you know, the people that need to meet with the McKessons of the world are us in this room, I think, you know, and we need to, you know, walk them through and handhold them so they get it right. I think McKesson's already been certified for lab reporting public
our
health.
Lab and our HIV, which is Relay Health.
Yep.
And actually, our lab product vendor, unfortunately, could not be here at this meeting, but I am emailing her constantly, and I am encouraged because I need to be here in
session. Good. What I would like to do, and maybe just meet one-on-one afterwards before you leave here today, and maybe a couple other people.
Be careful.
But
they
need a liaison, you know, and not many of them. I don't know. I'm afraid a lot of them haven't reached out, and they probably should have hired, you know, former ELR onboarding public health workers as they develop their product or something.
Well, Sharon.
Sherry Davidson from Alabama. I believe part of your question, Kathy, was asking about do they know what's reportable right off the bat. And so part of getting that message out in Alabama, we just revised our notifiable disease rule and the diseases that are notifiable. You know, some states do it every year. This was our first time even touching it since 2006. So we did a lot of updates to it, and as part of that, we're reaching out to the hospitals, the laboratories, the daycare administrators, everybody that's a required reporter. We're, I think it's 100,000 piece mail out that we're going to be sending out to the schools and everybody to let them know exactly what's reportable. We've also stood up three new web pages. One is detect, another one is test, and the other one is report, and each of those three words stand for something. The detect is saying what they need to be aware of, what they need to know is reportable. The report is how to report it and exactly what's reportable. For the laboratories, we specify it by organism. For the providers, we also say which test we prefer they perform to confirm their suspicions of what the patient has. So I think, you know, getting that out there now will also help those that when they're ready for the meaningful use, it won't be, oh, we were supposed to be reporting these. We're hoping, you know, they'll already have that piece of the puzzle and then they can see the ease of ELR, because if now they realize, oh, we're supposed to be reporting these, and they realize what a hassle it is to start, you know, sending in all these cards or emails or go to our website where they can report those now, that they'll say, oh, we can do this electronically, that's fabulous. So we'll also be promoting that message as well.
So I think that point and the other points that have been raised leads to a question that I was going to pose to the panel. Let me start with the panel, and then I'll open it up to the audience. As Kathy said, communication is key, and we all agree with that, but that requires resources and time to do it correctly. So my question to the panelists are, can you describe the types of resources you have put towards your meaningful use response, and perhaps address how scalable this model is, especially given the fire hose that was referenced earlier? And then lastly, do these resource allocations impact any existing work that was happening pre-MU? We'll start with Aaron, if you don't mind.
Similar to our experience with dealing with the HIE, a lot of the resources that our state public health department has received have been targeted to the immunization registry submissions. They have many more training partners to deal with than we would have for ELR. It's going to be bi-directional with the queries and updates and responses. So a lot of the resources up until this point have gone to the immunization registry submissions. That said, I think because they are, our immunization registry, I think, is much further along than we were with ELR as far as the volume that we were receiving electronically. Mm-hmm. So I think now some of the resource focus is starting to turn towards the ELR work. And just recently within the epidemiology business group within the Tennessee Department of Health, we've been actually given some human resources to assist with defining what exactly is reportable, how we articulate that to a lab versus a provider, updating our websites to make sure that we have that information publicly available, validating vocabulary, validating the HL7 structure, making sure we have people that are trained to look at an HL7 guide, that are familiar with RELMA and LOINC and how to look up SNOMEDs. We're actually starting to see some resources being designated to ELR now. But it's just been pretty recent.
Okay. Doug?
Answering that question can be multiple fold. I mean, how many people do we have doing ELR or doing immunizations? I can speak on behalf of ELR. We have a handful of staff, a couple of staff, that deal with ELR directly. But to answer the question and say, are we trying to do, you know, this many hospitals and trying to go through systems with, you know, just a handful of people, I think is kind of a wrong way to look at it. Because, again, we already had an infrastructure in place for the business rule or the business process of bringing on laboratories for laboratory reporting. The resources that are now available is again, we keep going back to Kathy because she brought up such a good point, and that is communication. Across our department, we have, you know, our leadership involved with meaningful use communications and planning. We have steering groups within our organization and involving the various partners to help promote that communication and capability. So there's been a lot of kind of in-kind participation within our department as well, too. For us, for me, very specifically, as we receive in, I'm the one who receives, you know, ultimately the messages, does the ocular validation, does the next step of validation. You know, I'm the one who determines. So it's you know, it all boils down to there in terms of the actions of moving things through. My issue isn't that I need to have more and more and more staff trying to accept this tsunami of data. I'm kind of looking at it before. You want to prevent a tsunami of a lot of bad data that you have to deal with and work with. So what we've been trying to do is make sure that resources are available and trying to target and identify how can we help the hospitals form up that good message at the very beginning. Because, again, the closer that the hospitals can come to a plug-and-play, the easier it is and the more likely it is the existing staff that we've had for this infrastructure can handle. We can handle the tsunami as long as the messages that are coming to us are good. We can handle it even if it's bad data, if you will. It's just that we're not going to really have anything to do because we're going to be bouncing it back to the hospitals to say, you need to fix this. I can't accept this. You need to be working on it. So a lot of the resources, you know, in the addition of resources, aren't necessarily needed at this very end of the game. It's needed before that in the form of the education with the providers, the communication with the providers, and trying to work at exactly how to get that message formed up properly.
Keith?
In Alabama, we've been able to piecemeal through different pieces of grants here and there, some money to fund a couple people specifically for meaningful use. Initially, just like Tennessee, that staff was really more focused on immunizations and meeting the requirements, not only for meaningful use, but the immunizations grant has their own requirements as far as data communication. They went ahead and went a step further, even though in phase one, bidirectional HL7 is not required. They went ahead and took that on. They've built that. They actually have a provider in production that is doing bidirectional HL7 with our immunization registry. And so if we're talking numbers of resources, I believe there was two developers that they were able to utilize to do that. Again, because the engagement process takes so much time, we were able to bring on a business analyst that kind of acts as that communications coordinator. And we're hoping to be able to, because we're funding through kind of piecemeal grants here and there, we're a little unsure how long we're going to be able to sustain that particular resource. For ELR, again, like Texas and Tennessee, we've had the infrastructure in place for quite some time. The change that needed to be made was to be able to consume the 251 message because we were already consuming 231. I've been able to utilize resources that are specifically funded for our surveillance system to help with the onslaught of hospitals that are interested in engaging for ELR. Syndromic surveillance, again, we're kind of using in-kind resources to stand that up. Our EPIs are very involved in that process. So we've recently, I believe, gotten some additional ELC funds to sustain and bring on a couple more developers for a short period of time. So like Doug said, we're hoping to position ourselves so that we're ready when the onslaught does come, because as you can see from our slide, we're dealing with a few hospitals here and there, some providers. But, you know, we're anticipating as this gets further along, vendors kind of figure out what they're doing, labs and hospitals start, you know, getting their act together, we could be quickly overwhelmed, but we're trying to prevent that.
So I'd pose that question to the audience in terms of resources. Yes?
Mark Dittman, Pennsylvania. I'm the ELR program manager there, and I could talk to Kathy about communications, but real quickly, with the MU approach, we're basically forcing everyone into the ELR path. We treat everyone just like they're a national lab. I don't care how small they are. And to address the resource issue, basically we say you are going to onboard for childhood blood lead because it's idiot-proof. It's one line code. It's real easy. And we use that as basically the stepping stone because I don't want to get into tuberculosis and susceptibilities. I don't want to go down the STD path and all of that. So we pick the bare bones basic message that makes somebody happy. And if we're having to work with a vendor, that makes it that much easier for them to start configuring their system to meet our specs, which are on our website, and I can talk about that. But PA NEDS is one of the more aged, I'll say, I won't say mature, advanced, we'll say aged systems out there. So we've been doing a lot of this stuff for a long time. So we have a lot of things on our website, PDFs of our state implementation guide, which I know some other states have copied in the past, but we make that available. Folks call us up and ask for that. I'll send it to you in a Word file if you want to use that to customize it. Of course, we're 231 spec, which complicates the MU. But we found and it decided just to go with that bloodlet message. Get that done. Send me that. You can self-attest that you've got a message that conforms, and then we put those folks into the regular ELR queue where we can work with them, because in Pennsylvania we typically do things condition by condition because we have to work with five different program areas. And we'll address them by volume. So if you're a big hepatitis reporter, we're probably going to go after hep first. You know, if you do a lot of influenza tests and we're coming up on that right time of the year, we'll do that. And we try to basically triage the entire perspective of what's your volume, what are your capabilities, what do my program people want to get from you. So it's kind of, there's a big plan, but it's a very dynamic plan, and we can mix and match what we're doing at the time, because at the same time we're still working with larger volume providers to onboard additional conditions. And I don't want to be putting meaningful use folks just for one little blood lead thing when their volume's 20 messages a month, right, and they've been doing data entry for years. You know, we don't want to compromise those other large labs. So it's a really, this is a dynamic process is the best we can do. So I think that's an approach. And I was wondering, as these guys are talking, is like, are you just onboarding, you know, throw it all at us and we'll just get a bigger bucket, you know, and how you try to manage that process.
Go ahead.
Yes, I do like to onboard, you know, and actually from a question earlier, you know, the condition list comment, we do look at all conditions that are reportable conditions that have a lab interest to them, because again, we're looking at the business process of replacing paper with electronic. And that actually brings up a point of, you know, that I'd wanted to bring up as well too, and that is another issue, kind of a different paradigm shift, if you will. We look at conditions, and whenever we're talking to laboratories, you know, hospitals, we'll describe to them, these are the conditions that we want to have reported. We don't get down and dirty and say, okay, you have to report this LOINC code, because oftentimes, A, we're under the assumption they may not have those LOINC codes embedded in their system, but we're not getting down to the granular level. You know, there also used to not be an entire LOINC code repository of everything that needs to be reported for each reportable condition. I mean, the tables that we had been using in the past for condition-specific LOINC and SNOMED codes was getting aged, and it wasn't complete, and we knew that wasn't distributable. So whenever we engage with a lab, whether it's a hospital lab or a major laboratory, you know, national laboratory or a regional lab, we will give them the list of reportable conditions and say, if you have any tests that are indicative of that reportable condition, that needs to be included in this batch message. Our programs are wanting that, because, you know, very specifically, if I'm working with a lab to bring on electronic laboratory reporting, I know our SDD program is going to come in and say, we want to bring them on electronically for ELR as well too. So what we're needing to do is bring on electronically as comprehensively as we can, especially from the get-go. The RCMT tables are, we haven't really gone to those because they are, you know, emerging, they're new. I'm going to be looking forward to how can we use that in that chicken and egg at the very beginning to say, do I need to talk to them according to reportable conditions, or do I need to talk to them in terms of, you know, these are the LOINCs for each of the reportable conditions, and kind of do some of that. What we're doing right now is saying, okay, you've had a legal obligation to report according to reportable conditions. the links that you should be using are the ones that are associated to what you've already been reporting already, and you have been reporting already, right? So you know, it's that whole chicken and egg right now in terms of how to communicate what should be part of that first message, that first batch that comes from them.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I did want to pose one final question to the panelists, and then perhaps take any last minute comments. So what I want to just get your perspectives on is, where do you hope to be a year from now when we come back to Atlanta next August in regards to meaningful use in public health? And I'll start with Keith.
You use the word hope, so
we can use whatever you'd like.
Where I would hope to be, no. I think realistically, you know, we could probably expect, you know, 10 to 20 hospitals to be in production next year. I mean, I think that's doable. Specifically, if they utilize a same vendor system, like maybe McKesson or something, that would be nice. With immunizations, I know that they're working with a lot of vendors. They have a lot of them kind of, I mean, just they need 5% more to be 100% and be able to go into production. So realistically, I could foresee us having you know, immunization messaging from multiple vendors, hospitals, you know, again, from maybe the 10 to 20 range, hopefully providing us real-time data. I want to touch on, I can't remember the gentleman's question. We did have one hospital that basically said, look, we get our data from multiple, I guess, multiple systems from within their lab. So they did ask us, would you be willing to just accept STD testing, because we can readily do that. So we're glad to get any data that we can get from them. So we will take it that way. Again, our preference is, like Doug mentioned, we would like to get all reportable conditions and work through that and get one feed at a time. But again, if that's what they're willing and able to give at the time, we accept it.
Erin?
So I'll approach this question or this answer in regards to two aspects. One, in regards to the numbers, you know, our immunization registry is going to be trucking along, onboarding, promoting the bidirectional. And right now, I believe we're able to consume the 231 version of the immunization messages, and I believe we're in the process of implementing the necessary technology to have the same for the 251. I believe we can do one of the three in 251, but not all three. In regards to syndromic surveillance a year from now, I would like, so right now in Tennessee, syndromic surveillance is a local function. It's performed, it's not centralized at the state where there's one system similar to our NEDS reporting. It's local. It meets the needs of the local people who are going to respond to those situations. A year from now, I would like to see us have more of a centralized, standardized mechanism by which that information can be communicated to the locals to enable them to get the information quicker, more reliable, more valid, as well as to allow for the Tennessee Department of Health to be a participant in the syndromic surveillance meaningful use option. In regards to ELR, a year from now, I'd like to see us have at least, we should have at least 50 of our 116 or so facilities in production. In addition, when I first came on to this project and started working with NEDS and ELR, the very first thing that we started doing was making sure that we did have the infrastructure to consume a 251 that was received. Because at that point, we were only getting 231 from LabCorp and Mayo. And I know we've been working with our state lab to be able to consume a 251. We're working with our state lab for them to be able to send us a 251. And the very first thing we did, like I mentioned, was start off making sure that we had the necessary infrastructure. We use Orion, Rapstein, MSS to be able to take a 251 message, bust it up if we need to, send it to the necessary surveillance systems, including STD, MIS, EHARP, the STD system, PRISM, EHARS, LED. We've even started working on a route to send information back and forth with Alabama. I guess the next piece that we really need to refine is our onboarding process and our testing process. You know, up until this point, what we have been doing for these several years is that we've been getting ELR has worked, but I think when that fire hose opens, we will need to have a more efficient, streamlined process to make this process a lot faster. So that's, I'd like to have that worked out within a year.
Okay. Doug?
I'm not going to disagree with anything they said in terms of where we need to go and how we need to be going. You know, I a year from now, you know, looking at the number of acute care hospitals that we have sitting in front of me, and where we need to be going, my expectation isn't to have all 550, you know, acute care hospitals, you know, sending me that cheerful little message and everything's going and, you know, life is good. What I am looking forward to, though, is the impact on how this is going to be affecting, you know, public health and the things that we are doing already. And what I mean by that is in 2010, we had about 130,000 laboratory slips in our NEDS-based system itself. 83% of those came to us electronically from major laboratory facilities. Those are just the general communicable disease messages. That doesn't include any of our HIV or STD messages. It does not include any of the lab messages. Upon receipt of both of those categories of messages, it also does not include cancer reports, pathology reports that we receive, or birth defects that we receive. All of those are kind of fractioned off and made into a format or provided in a format that are conducive to those existing applications. So very specifically looking at the NEDS-based system, that 83-84% that we were receiving electronically, I'm hoping that a year from now that we can have a much higher percentage of electronic receipt. You know, who's coming on board right now? It's the big major players. Yes, there are some also, you know, smaller and some of the independents. That's fine and that's good. It's all cheerfully and merrily go along our way. But the big guys are coming in as well, too, and they're going to have the impact on receiving the data electronically that we had been receiving via paper or the old traditional routes. I'm looking forward to a year from now having an impact in that component, that fraction of the high-volume paper reporters being converted over to an electronic laboratory reporting mechanism, not the expectation that we would have all 550 coming to us electronically.
Well, with that, it's 9:30, so I'd like to take a minute and thank the panelists for their insights today.